Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Professional Responsibility and Legal Education Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, May 11, 2018, during a live teleform conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's teleform conference call, as today we discuss the book John Marshall and the Cases That United the States of America. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, Director of Practice Groups, and General Counsel here at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future and will likely be transcribed. The book we're discussing today, John Marshall and the Cases That United the States of America, was, of course, written by Professor Ronald Rotunda, a longtime Federalist Society member and leader. If you hadn't heard, sadly, he passed away unexpectedly very recently, and he's sorely missed by the organization and by his family and friends. He was involved with the Federalist Society when I arrived over 20 years ago, and he was a stalwart participant in everything Federalist Society for decades. He had an extraordinary career as a professor, touching the lives of thousands of students, and in addition to that legacy, leaving behind a collection of important articles, books, and appearances across the country and even across the world. So I'm very happy and privileged to welcome our guest today and to be discussing his latest book. Again, it's John Marshall and the Cases That United the States of America. We're going to hear opening remarks from each of our guests, but at this point I'm going to turn it over to our moderator, Jack Park, who's known to most of you in the audience, I would expect. He is the chairman of the Federalist Society's Professional Responsibility and Legal Education Practice Group Executive Committee, on which Ron Rotunda served for so long. With that, Jack Park, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Dean. As Dean said, this afternoon we'll discuss the late Ron Rotunda's last book, John Marshall and the Cases That United the States of America. Ron's book is an abridgment of Alfred Beveridge's four-volume biography of Chief Justice Marshall, volumes one and two of which were published in 1916 and volumes three and four in 1919. Ron says of Beveridge's work, "His history, even the factual trivia, is fascinating. His portrait of Marshall is compelling and his writing superb." Ron's book links his own introductory commentary with the sterling prose of Beveridge, and thereby trying to make Beveridge's work more accessible to readers today. And one of the significant things that Ron did in an appendix was to collect the works cited by Beveridge in his four-volume biography, and that collection shows the breadth of Beveridge's research. We're delighted to have Professor Stephen Presser, soon to be visiting scholar in conservative thought and policy at the University of Colorado in Boulder, and Professor James Ely, now emeritus from Vanderbilt Law School, to speak with us today. Their biographies are in the announcement, and each is clearly well qualified to discuss the constitutional legacy of Chief Justice Marshall as reflected in the work of Beveridge and Ron Rotunda. As Dean said, Ron died unexpectedly and untimely in March 2017, about a month ago. He was a scholar, the co-author of treatises on constitutional law and legal ethics, and much commentary. He frequently appeared on panels at the National Lawyers Convention, including a panel last year on the proposed ABA Rule 8.4G, and participated in the legal ethics CLE teleforums that the Federalist Society hosted. As anyone who has seen him speak or saw him speak, Ron was lucid, he was erudite, and he was entertaining. And I'd like to point to two instances at which his wit appears in his editorial contributions. At one point, he writes, "One might think of the nine justices of the present court as a group of prima donnas united by a common parking lot." And the second, he points out that Joseph Story left Congress after one term, in part because of his disgust with political chicanery. Ron observes, "Yes, some things never change. Two centuries ago, there already was political chicanery in politics." I'd like to now turn the microphone over to Professor James Ely and welcome him for his remarks.
Thank you, Jack. It's a privilege to be on a program honoring Ron. I did not know Ron well, but he and I served together on a program some years ago, maybe more than I care to remember, and I was indeed struck that he was a gentleman and a consummate scholar. It was certainly a privilege to have known him, however briefly, and I've always greatly admired his work, which I have often had occasion to cite. Let me turn now, if I may, to a few thoughts about his abridgment of Beveridge's famous Life of John Marshall. One of the signal achievements, of course, that Ron has achieved here is to make this four-volume set accessible to a modern audience. It's not easily available, and quite frankly, for modern audiences, four volumes might be seen as a bit excessive. He's done an excellent job of carving out, I think, some of the meat from these four volumes, but also preserving some of Beveridge's very colorful and very powerful language. That being said, I would like to offer four comments, or three comments anyway, that pertain to the volume itself. First, I think that Beveridge falls into a problem that has plagued other scholars as well in their desire to recognize Marshall's signal achievements, and no one is denying that there were signal achievements, in strengthening the Supreme Court. They tend, I think, to downplay and overlook the pre-Marshall court. In fact, Justices Chase, Wilson, Jay, Patterson had all written significant opinions, either on the Supreme Court bench or during their time on circuit duties. And our other panelist, Steve Presser, I know has written very perceptively about the pre-Marshall court, but I do think that that is an area of study that warrants more attention than it often gets. Supreme Court history did not, in fact, just begin in 1801 with John Marshall. My second thought pertains to the pervasive theme running throughout the Beveridge volume, that is to say, his association of John Marshall with nationalism. He uses that phrase over and over without much definition and associates Marshall repeatedly with nationalism. Now, that is true, I think, up to a point, but it also needs to be qualified, to my mind, in some respects. Marshall never, ever decided that every single case had to be resolved in favor of national power over residue of authority in the states. So it seems to me it has to be qualified. Marshall was concerned, to be sure, with promoting commerce and helping to identify a national market, and he was concerned repeatedly with state interference with the national market or state interference with the organs of the national government, to which the national bank. But I don't think it is accurate to conclude that he always decided everything in favor of national power. For example, the famous steamboat monopoly case, we had the state of New York clearly interfering with movement of passengers and goods across state lines from New Jersey to New York. I do not read Marshall as ever saying that the power of Congress was extensive to cover every and all human activity. That's more or less what it's come to be now. Rather, I understand him to be saying that states cannot interfere with the creation of a national market, and that, it seems to me, is very important, but it does suggest some qualification. Also, note that Marshall decided correctly, I think, that the original Bill of Rights was understood as applying only to the national government. It did not impose limitations on the states, so states were free before the adoption of the 14th Amendment, to do a number of things that might have been prohibited to the national government. Here, I think, very clearly is the suggestion that Marshall, although a nationalist, was not a consolidationist who saw no role for state autonomy. Let me turn then for my third point to the Beveridge treatment of the contract clause, a subject which is of interest to me, particularly his long chapter on the Dartmouth College case. Now, Beveridge does a wonderful job of bringing out the colorful background of this case and the emotional arguments in Daniel Webster's famous oration on behalf of the college, etc. However, The Dartmouth College case, I think, may not be quite as significant as Beveridge paints it. For one thing, as Beveridge notes, states almost immediately began to adopt reservation clauses reserving the right to revoke or modify corporate charters. This, of course, had the effect of substantially diluting the reach of the Dartmouth College opinion. Now, yes, the Dartmouth College case did give some support to stability of corporate charters against hostile state action, but no, it did not prevent states from taking any action with respect to corporations. Indeed, curiously enough, at the end of a chapter in which he exalts the Dartmouth College case, his own misgivings begin to come through. Bear in mind that Beveridge was actively involved in the progressive movement of the early years of the 20th century, and the progressives were taking a great deal of aim at the Dartmouth College case. It began to be very sharply criticized in some quarters. And so these misgivings manifest themselves, and Beveridge, at the end of the chapter, says, well, it probably wouldn't be decided the same way today. So ultimately what he's saying is, yes, it was great in Marshall's day, but not so good by 1916. And it's a little bit of a twist there, I think, on the exaltation of the Dartmouth College case. On the other hand, I do want to say that there was a tendency on the Marshall Court, certainly, to want to protect contractual stability. That was important to Marshall. I think that comes through in a number of cases, not just Dartmouth College, but a number of cases. Well, with that, I'm going to turn it over to Steve.
Well, thank you very much, Jim. And let me say, as you did, what a treat it is to be here. And it's a particular treat for me to talk about Ron, who I started with, I think, 46 years ago as an associate at Wilmer Cutler and Pickering in Washington. And he became a real titan in constitutional law. And as if that weren't an honor enough, to be here with Jim Ely, who's been one of my heroes, again, for about four decades, is extraordinary. And I guess I should say I don't disagree with anything at all that Jim has said. I will just make a few remarks on some other aspects of this book and of John Marshall generally. I think Beveridge, as a progressive and as somebody who I believe really thought the federal government could do some extraordinary things for the country, painted Marshall in a way that we've come to accept as a great champion of, at least in Beveridge's book, creative jurisprudence. And I think my own feeling has always been that Beveridge is the start of using John Marshall to justify a very creative role for the federal judiciary in particular, and as a sort of prototype of Earl Warren. But the genius of Beveridge as a historian and the genius of Ron Rotunda as an editor is to put Marshall, I think, a little bit more firmly in his own era and time, and suggest maybe some problems with that view of Marshall as a great expounder of judicial power. One of the wonderful, wonderful things about the book that I think Jim didn't mention that maybe I can say is what shines through, among other things, all through this book is Jefferson and his role as an antagonist of Marshall. Indeed, I think Marshall loathed his cousin Thomas quite a bit, and the book is full of instances in which the two of them clashed, although I think they had a fairly profound respect for each other in some ways. Another aspect of the book that meant a lot to me, as Jim alluded a little bit to, is the long treatment of the Chase impeachment and the situation of Marshall in a period when the court was very much a political football. The Chase impeachment came after, I guess it was the Pickering impeachment, and John Marshall, I think, thought that he was next. The Jeffersonians were out to gut the federal judiciary, since it was the last repository of Federalists in the government. And miraculously, they thought better of it, at least the senators did, and didn't convict Chase, and Marshall was safe. But from that time on, I think Marshall was very, very careful to avoid plunging the court excessively in political controversy. One thing that ought to be emphasized about this book, which I think probably belongs on the shelf of anybody who cares about the early republic or constitutional law or legal history generally, is it's got an incredible "you are there" feel. The extraordinary talent that Beveridge had for melding politics and law and history, I think Ron has preserved and enhanced. And it reads like an adventure story in many ways. It's also big with big print, which is great, especially at our age, I think. I could go on, but I think that covers the basic points that I wanted to make. It's an extraordinary book about an extraordinary time by two now extraordinary men, Beveridge and Rotunda. And I'll turn it back now to Jack Park.
Well, thank you both. Before we open the floor to questions, I just want to note that, and maybe ask one, Beveridge says that Marbury versus Madison is a judicial coup d'etat. My old boss, now Judge Bill Pryor, wrote an article pointing out that the notion of judicial review had a substantial history that is not really reflected in the Marbury decision. And Ron writes, "When we understand Marbury and its limits, we also appreciate how Marshall's assertion of judicial review was much more modest than the power that the modern court exerts." Do you think, is Beveridge right, or do you think Ron's right, or both right?
Well, I think they're both, and you know, this is Stephen Presser. I think they're both right in a way. One of the extraordinary things about Marbury versus Madison is that Marshall asserted the power of judicial review and then used it in order to prevent acting in a way that Jefferson would have ignored as president. I think it's undeniable that judicial review precedes Marshall, and as Jim mentioned a little bit earlier in his sort of suggestion that there were great men before Agamemnon, The power of judicial review was asserted several times by early Supreme Court justices sitting on circuit. It could not have been clearer in Federalist 78, which, of course, was contemporary with the Constitution. And there were even instances running all the way back to the time of Sir Edward Coke, in which at least there were some suggestions that courts had a power to throw out at least some acts of legislatures. And I think both Ron and Beveridge overstate Marshall's achievement in that regard.
Jim Ely, let me just say I would concur with what Steve says. There is ample evidence that people were thinking in terms of judicial review before Marshall. While his opinion is very creative and he deals with the political connotations vis-a-vis Jefferson very skillfully, he didn't make it up.
Yeah, this is Jack. Beveridge, in his writing, points out it a couple times how the result of the decision was not to give the commission to Marbury. So he effectively avoided provoking Jefferson too much. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. Just wanted to make one quick comment. I'd be interested in what Jim thinks about this. As Jim knows very well, there was a big controversy in the pre-Marshall court about the applicability of the English common law to the federal courts, particularly in criminal areas. But basically thought for a long time when I thought about Marbury versus Madison, that Marshall didn't have to decide it the way he did, that one could have, on common law grounds, have just decided that the power of mandamus was possessed by the federal courts with or without a statute. And I think declaring that portion of the statute unconstitutional was really quite a stretch indulged in order to avoid, I think, the politics of the issue at that point.
Certainly the whole notion of Jim Ely again, the whole notion of common law crimes had been hugely controversial in the early, very early years of the Republic. And it might well be that Marshall could have, in fact, resolved the case on some different ground.
Very well. Dean, would you like to open the floor to audience questions?
Let's do that. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question for either or any of our guests, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question, please push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got plenty of time left for lots of questions. Our lines are wide open. Jack, we'll just have to wait and see if folks ring in. Nobody yet. Again, push the star button, then the pound button if you have a question for one of our experts. But with that, Jack Park, I pitch it back to you to carry on the conversation.
Yeah, I guess one thing we've talked about is how Beveridge makes some really sweeping claims Professor Ely talked about how the nationalizing effect. And, I think when Beveridge writes in 1916, a lot of this, the changes that came with the New Deal were still in the future. So he still has a resonance of Marshall's jurisprudence, although, as Professor Ely is well aware, the contract clause had jurisprudence had undergone some substantial changes. And one of the things I note, Beveridge was in a position that it looks like to interview one of Marshall's granddaughters, which is really a remarkable thing. Do you think that historical, Beveridge falls, does that reflect a resonance with Marshall, in your judgment, that we no longer can have today just because of the effect of time?
Stephen Presser, Jim probably has more insight in this than I do, but one of the extraordinary things about this book, I alluded to it a little bit earlier, is that Beveridge, as somebody who is a senator, has a real feel for politics and a real feel for how the Senate operates and how political parties operate. And much of what he says in this book, when he talks about the motivations of the particular actors, I think does have incredible resonance today. I'm not sure that his particular treatment of constitutional issues has as much, but the deep understanding of the interplay between law and politics and culture, I think makes the book extraordinarily timely. And the split between the Jeffersonians and the Federalists, which in a way mirrors our own split between today's Republicans and Democrats, I think offers some, at least intriguing, speculation, if not some historical lessons.
Well, it's also interesting to reflect on the fact that much of the work of the Marshall Court, and indeed had been very controversial. There was attempts, as Steve has already mentioned, to impeach Chase and perhaps the entire bench. The court caught up in political issues, not all of its own making. And I think you see some of that today, certainly. The struggle to get anybody confirmed in the Senate today, it just suggests that there's this enormous interplay, however much we may care to try to deny it or close our eyes, enormous interplay between law and politics. And I think Beveridge is certainly right on as far as that's concerned.
How about his feel for the context of Marshall's time? I tend to think that folks back then had a better feel for how the framers thought than perhaps we do today, perhaps because of the gulf of the jurisprudence of the 1930s and its continuing effects.
I think there's a lot of truth in that. This is Presser. But what astonishes me whenever I go back and read somebody like Beveridge is how little politics have changed and how little human nature has changed over the course of the country. One thing that has changed is the idea of great men in history, and particularly great white men these days, is not something that dominates the analysis in the universities. But a book like this reminds us that people like Marshall and Beveridge and Washington and Chase really were, and Hamilton and Madison and Jefferson really were titans. And it's a delight to be able to go back and look at that again.
Yes, yeah, certainly. When I first went to Princeton way back in the 1950s, we would have an exercise on the so-called great man theory of history. Well, I suspect that is long gone. So this is definitely I don't mean to say a throwback, but it definitely reflects that school of thought, that there are significant figures who do make in their own time a tremendous impact. Possibly in the case of Beveridge, he may have exaggerated Marshall a teeny bit here and there, but nonetheless, he sees Marshall as a person who had a real impact. And so that's different than the kind of books today where everything is forces and causes and trends and this type of thing. And people as actors are not given a secondary role, let's say.
Absolutely.
But Jack,
and there's even...
Go ahead, Steve.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Steve.
Go ahead.
Well, for all...
For
all of that historical, change, if you go back and look at the founding, Washington is the indispensable man.
Absolutely.
That's an observation that I was going to make. Go ahead, Steve.
And I was just going to say that something along those lines, towards the end of this book, there's a controversy over the Cherokees and the famous remark about that Andrew Jackson made, that John Marshall has now rendered his decision in favor of the Cherokees, let him go ahead and enforce it. Meaning, of course, Jackson was going to do nothing to enforce it. And it reminds us, again, of the political struggle. And I guess, as you were pointing out, Jack, not only is Washington the indispensable man, but Marshall himself wrote, I think, a four-volume biography of Washington and had an incredible admiration for him. There's a new book out, as you may be aware, of speeches by Antonin Scalia. And oddly enough, what emerges from that book is that his favorite founder is, in fact, George Washington, not usually regarded as a titan of constitutional law, but apparently a figure of extraordinary gravity and extraordinary influence, as you suggest.
Well, Jack, this is Dean Reuter. We do have one question in our audience. Should we turn to the audience now?
Yeah, let's turn to the audience, Dean.
And a reminder, if you're in the audience, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. For now, let's take our first question.
Hi, gentlemen. So my question kind of follows up the discussion you've just been having, but I obviously haven't read the book yet. But my question is, are there lessons in the book that might be specifically applied to today's circumstances that would be kind of relevant to the the sorts of principles and ideals that the Federalist Society promotes. We, as you allude, are in a tug of war today, as we've been perhaps throughout the history of the Republic on those kinds of issues. But are there lessons in the book that as takeaways on that?
Who wants to take a shot at that?
Well, this is Presser. I'll take a quick shot at it. In so far as the book is a sustained attack on Thomas Jefferson and his ideas, really, that towards the end of his life came close to pure democracy, there's a powerful lesson for Federalist Society members on maintaining the rule of law and remembering that sometimes popular passions can get out of hand. The Federalist Society also very much, I think, stands for a notion that Jim alluded to a little bit earlier, and that's that ours is a dual sovereignty and that nationalism isn't all there is. The book isn't exactly a brief for draining the swamp, but it reminds you of that a little bit. So rule of law and federalism are at least powerful themes that are in the book.
Certainly, Jim Ealy certainly agreed. The rule of law, I think, is a very powerful theme in the book. And coupled with that, I think, is the important role of the judiciary. Not that the judiciary was to be always dominant, which at times it may have seen more recently, but that the judiciary was to play an important and independent role, and one that would be sorely challenged by Andrew Jackson in a number of areas and fronts during Marshall's own time. And you can understand how despairing Marshall and Story would have been over some of Andrew Jackson's actions. I mean, the displacement of the Cherokees is just one example among others. The bank war, in which he basically disregards the Supreme Court decisions upholding the National Bank, that would have been very frustrating, I think, to Marshall and Story. I think it was very frustrating. So I guess I've come away thinking that the rule of law and respect for an independent judiciary are important themes.
Stephen Presser, again, I just wanted to make one comment based on what Jim said. I was surprised, going back to this book, how powerful a role and how big a part of the Beveridge analysis Story plays. We forget how important he really was. And that was one of the special treats, I think, to see the fabulous friendship that developed between Marshall and Story, and the way in which Story disappointed the Jeffersonians by going over to the Federalists. But that's a part of the book that we ought to stress.
In I think it's in Marbury versus Madison, where Marshall writes about the role of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what it ought to be, or words to that effect. And that's something that the Federalist Society has picked up, perhaps again in reaction to some of the events that post-date Beveridge in our legal history. So echoing what Professor Presser just said, there's another chapter that's a remarkable view of Marshall just personally and of the times where everybody traveled on horseback, the streets were not paved, and they were dusty when it was dry and swampy when it was wet. And it's just a remarkable view of the time as well.
Well, and of course, that directly played into the difficulties, almost the hazards, of the circuit duties that were required of the court. It's easy to forget that members of the Supreme Court were required to conduct circuit courts within their appointed regions, and that must have been a very onerous assignment. And I know many of the justices complained about it, had to travel by horseback in the rain or the snow to these remote courthouses and conduct trials. would have been a very onerous dimension of their of that job.
Quite true, and I think Jim will remember that it's alleged that circuit riding actually killed North Carolina Supreme Court Justice James Iredell.
James Iredell, yes, exactly.
Well, and Beveridge, I think, points to a couple instances of overturned carts or falls from horses. So it was very hazardous. Dean, do we have any other questions?
Not at the moment, but if you're in the audience, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. And maybe, Jack, I can get a question in here while we're waiting to see who else might join. We do have one other caller with a question. But I was going to ask maybe more of Professor Ely than Professor Presser, since he's already expressed surprise at one part, that is the how much story's role in the story he found as a surprise. I'm wondering if there were any other surprises in the book for either of our guests.
Well, I think consistent with his themes, which was basically his national theme, I think he was pretty consistent throughout. I was surprised, at least in the material, and I haven't seen the four-volume set, but at least in the material here, I was surprised there wasn't more treatment of the Baltimore and Barron case, in which Marshall decided that the Bill of Rights did not apply to the national government. That, would have been somewhat inconsistent with his main argument, and maybe he treats that in the four-volume set, but it certainly didn't stand out in this abridgment, and that, to me, was a bit of a surprise.
Interesting. Professor Presser, you mentioned the role of story, his outsized role, as being a bit of a surprise. Anything else sort of catch you off guard as you read through?
Well, I knew about it, but the constant reiteration of the duplicity of the Jeffersonians, I thought was maybe not surprising, but certainly delightful.
Right.
There is, in fact, in Beveridge, an ability to make these late 18th and early 19th century figures seem almost Shakespearean. The description that he gives of the Chase impeachment trial and John Randolph, who led the arguments for the prosecution, and many, many other characters and senators, is very much larger than life and just delightful in a law book. One quote of Ron Rotunda's that we should mention, that I quote in my latest book, is Ron said, "One extraordinary thing about most writing by law professors is that it's unreadable." And that's certainly not the case with this book, which is very, very readable.
The book is certainly very, didn't mean to cut you off, I'm so sorry. The book is certainly very readable and colorful anecdotes throughout. But you know, another thing I think comes out of this book is the amount of, frankly, just plain nasty politics that characterized the period. I hear today almost every day, oh, this is the most dysfunctional and upset, bitter time in American political history. I just don't think that's nonsense. I think people do not have enough historical grasp to realize that it was pretty bad at some other periods of time. And characters like Jefferson and Jackson aroused enormous antagonism, a great deal of bitterness. And while they all had achievements, we shouldn't overlook the fact that there was a lot of controversy and a lot of bitterness over things that were done.
Even the occasional duel.
Well, exactly. And I mean, it's nice that this appears, this apotheosis of Marshall, in a readable, indeed exciting manner, appears at the same time that the musical Hamilton does. I think there's some of the same ground being covered.
Interesting. We do have one question pending. If you'd like to join the queue, if you're in the audience, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let's take another question from another caller now.
Hi, guys. Can you hear me?
We can hear you just fine. Go right ahead.
Hi, it's David Forte. How are you, fellas?
Hello, David.
Hi. I think everything you've said about the book, which I'm working on now myself, is wonderful and insightful. And everything you've related about the larger contribution and perspective of beverage is right on point. As we know, and you pointed out, beverage, of course, was writing at the waxing and instantiation of the nationalist progressive image that was infecting or influencing not only the Democratic Party but the Republican Party at the time, and so he was looking at things through that image. But in that sense, we tend to think he might have distorted Marshall, but in one sense he gets Marshall right, I am suggesting, in his emphasis on nationalism, and gets Jefferson right in his criticism of Jefferson, and that is the constitutional debate as to what the nature of the Constitution was. The big image of Marshall wasn't nationalism, I suggest, qua nationalism, but that the Constitution was created independently by the people from the jurisdiction of the states, or out of the jurisdiction of the states, taken away from the jurisdiction of the states. And this debate, which came to the fore as early as 1798 in the Virginia, and 1799 in the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions, which of course Marshall was involved in his responses, pitted the two images of the formation of the Constitution as a compact of states, or as a compact among the people of the several states creating a different entity. And that, I think, was Marshall's great image. His image was for the Constitution qua Constitution, not for the national government qua national government. To the extent the national government was a child of the Constitution, he would celebrate that. But I think that theme, that quote-unquote nationalist theme, is central to Marshall, and that great contribution of what the nature of our Constitution is, I think, was correct. And I think his fears of reverting to the idea of a compact of states was borne fruit after his death, ultimately leading to the Civil War. So in one sense, I think Beveridge does get it right.
Well, I certainly think that Marshall's nationalism, as you are describing it, is a very apt, very astute analysis. It was never that the federal government should run everything. That was a complete corruption introduced much later. But it was that we were a national union, not a compact of states. And I think, to some extent, what he fears is, and many of his opinions basically are trimming state authority to interfere with what he regards as the national union. So I think that you are exactly right, and this is carried forward into Daniel Webster's famous speeches in Congress about the nature of the union. I think a lot of that could flow right out of Marshall.
This is Presser again. I agree with all of that. Although as time goes on, I wonder if the compact theory of the states has received over the years too short shrift. It's true that Beveridge paints Marshall as a sort of precursor to Lincoln, and Story certainly didn't have any regard for the compact theory either. But I think that there's more to be said for it, and indeed more to be said for the case of states having the right to secede, perhaps, than we talk about much today. There is a powerful theme in the book that does emerge about the northern states possibly seceding in reaction to Jefferson and Madison and the tariff. But I'm sorry, and other issues. But I wonder if it's as clear cut as we tend to think, that the Constitution represents really a very much substitution for earlier ideas about the states being paramount. After all, as the book I think does point out, it's only after the Civil War that we talk about the United States in the singular rather than the plural.
Yes, and of course the war would have changed attitudes almost irrevocably in that subject, I think.
Right.
Well, Jack, this is Dean again. The book, of course, just a reminder to our audience, is John Marshall and the Cases That United the States of America. Came out in January 2018. It's available at bookstores and on Amazon.com and other online sellers. If you have a question for our experts, our lines are wide open right now. You need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. But with none pending, Jack, I'll turn it back to you.
Well, I'd like to offer each of you, let's start with Professor Ely, a chance to wrap up then. If you have any concluding remarks.
Well, this has been a very, very enjoyable exchange. I'm nice to have a chance to kick some ideas around with my longtime friend, Steve Presser. And I would say that this is a volume that I could highly recommend to anybody in the audience who would like to have a almost read it like a novel. You've got a discount to some extent, maybe from where the author is coming from on some issues, but it's a very good introduction, not only to the work of the Marshall Court, but also to John Marshall personally. There's a lot of personal history in here, and of course about his fraught relations with his second cousin, Thomas Jefferson. So that, I think, would pretty much wrap it up for me.
This is Presser. I just want to concur completely with everything that Jim Ely just said. And I guess one thing that we've alluded to, but we might mention again, is the book is very useful for telling you about the shortcomings of partisan politics and the dangers to our republic when we split too far from each other and forget that we're not really about divergent ideologies. We're about preserving the Constitution. It's lasted for more than two centuries, and it's important, I think, that we remember that it's our duty to make it last for another few.
This is Jack. I've been honored to join you both, and I recommend the book. I just finished it, and it's just really muscular prose and very colorful and a very rewarding read. And as both of our experts have pointed out, the weaving of the politics and the position of the court by Beveridge is remarkably well done. So, Dean, I think unless there's anything else, I think we're concluded.
Very good. Thank you, gentlemen, for this. I thought it was a nice tip of the hat to our friend, Professor Ronald Rotunda. Let me say a final time the name of the volume we've been discussing, John Marshall and the Cases That United the States of America. So thank you all for participating. I want to thank the audience as well for dialing in and for their questions, and a reminder to the audience to check their emails and monitor our website for the next scheduled teleforum conference call. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone.
Yeah.